Hey gang, just a reminder that our Voices of Quarantine episode is coming up and we need your contributions. Use the Voice Memo app on your phone to record yourself and maybe even your kids singing a fish-related song, telling a fishing story, a fish joke, just whatever light fish-related content you can. We'll compile them into an episode to put out in just a couple of weeks, so get recording. Deadline to be included in the episode will be April 15th at midnight. Send entries to julie.vecchio@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope we can have some fun together. I'm going to be telling the story of how I almost landed a sand tiger shark from a research boat in the middle of the night, and my three-year-old is really excited to read us one of his favorite fish books and sing a couple of songs for us. Here's a preview.
Babe shark, do, 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 do. Babe shark. Hello, I am a fish. Why did it go over my neck?
Thank you for joining me. I'm Julie Vecchio, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at FisheriesPod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. If you enjoy the show and would like to become a sponsor, please head over to patreon.com/fisheriespodcast. For as little as $1 a month, you can help out and receive a Fisheries Podcast sticker in the mail. Our show is free, but the internet is not. It costs us about $30 a month to keep the show on the air. If you'd like to help us offset that cost, please consider becoming a patron. Danielle, or Danny Blumstead, is currently a PhD student in the University of New Hampshire in the Department of Molecular, Cellular, and Biomedical Sciences, where she's studying genome evolution and adaptive diversity. Her current research is actually focused on investigating the genomic basis of desert adaptations in mice, but promises to get back around to fish in our conversation. Danny grew up in West Bloomfield, Michigan, and she got her bachelor's degree in zoology at Michigan State University, where she studied lake sturgeon and burbot. She got her master's in natural resources at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, where she looked at the genetics in Cisco. During her degree, she used the genetic map to study how the Salmonid family had genetically evolved post-whole genome duplication. Welcome to the podcast, Danny.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you. So to start off with, you and I actually grew up in a very similar area of the country. We were basically about 20 minutes away from each other in Southeast Michigan. Having grown up there, I wouldn't necessarily say it's a particularly outdoorsy sort of area. What's your earliest memory of being interested in science or the outdoors?
Yeah, so it's really not outdoorsy at all, like you said. But I actually went to summer camp for quite a few years. And the main part of summer camp was we went on a backcountry hiking and canoeing trip that, as we got older, it got progressively harder and more legitimate outdoors. So that's really where I met outside. But for me, science really didn't click until I was in undergrad. I actually spent most of my time in high school doing absolutely horribly in all of the basic science classes. And it wasn't until I took general chemistry at Michigan State that I actually liked science and was good at it.
Wow, that is kind of backwards from what a lot of people say about chemistry in college. College chemistry yeah. is usually a class that people are like, oh, it's terrible.
Yeah, it finally kind of clicked. And I think it had to do with how the information was presented. Where like high school, it wasn't really adapted to somebody who had like ADD, who could never really sit still, who didn't learn from, I don't know, it just never worked until I finally got to college where the classes just were better for my learning style.
So chemistry got you into science, undergraduate chemistry.
It didn't last very long. After like those initial chemistry courses, that was it. Like that was the end.
That was the end of chemistry for you?
That was the end of chemistry.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, I feel a little bit better about myself now. Organic was probably like the worst class I ever took. I just couldn't get those 3D forms. Something I couldn't do. So you went to Michigan State University and got your undergraduate in zoology. Is that what you were always studying throughout undergrad?
Yeah. So I switched my major like 4 or 5 times over the course of 4 years. And I just like jumped from major to major long enough to get like the department information. And in my sophomore year, I got an email from the department saying there was an opening in a lab. So I was like, okay, cool. I'll join a lab. And it ended up being a genetics lab. And that kind of fed my major jumping even more because I was trying to find a major that was basically conservation genetics, and they didn't have that. So I went from like fisheries and wildlife, which ours was very management focused, which wasn't entirely what I wanted, to like environmental studies and sustainability. I was like, oh, I'll try the policy side of it, and that didn't work. And then I was like, but if I do zoology, I lose all that like kind of ecology that goes on, because our zoology program is very basic science oriented. So I kept kind of like tweaking it until I just was like, they told me I had to choose a major, and I was like, okay. So that's kind of, I got into fisheries just by joining a lab by accident.
I mean, it sounds like you were always had a similar focus throughout that you
were
really looking for.
Yeah, like, they were all very related majors, which was kind of in my favor.
Yeah, I mean, you weren't going from like religion to zoology or anything like that.
Well, that would have definitely added a few years.
Yeah, that's for sure. So this is where you got your start in fisheries genetics. Can you tell me a little bit about the lab you worked in there and what sorts of projects that you worked on?
Yeah, so I ended up working for Dr. Kim Scribner in the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife. He works on many, many things, but he's largely focused on lake sturgeon and conservation genetics from a very like population genetic standpoint. It was just like the coolest thing I'd ever seen. Like we were doing kind of an older version of genetics where compared to like this modern crazy stuff that I'm trying to learn, we were doing a slightly older version. And it was just like, you were looking at these like physical images of gels and they were just gorgeous. Like I actually hung one up in my office for a while because it didn't even matter what it told me, but it was just like so cool to look at.
I think it's been a long time since people really looked at the images of the gels.
Yeah, most people, that's like it's a dying art form in my kind of personal opinion, because like you learn all this stuff about genetics, and you kind of like, you learn all these stats and all these like very specific genetic things, but you never actually look at the like DNA anymore. You don't score by hand. You're not genotyping by hand anymore. And it kind of loses it loses that connection between reality and just like some number you're plugging into the computer. It really helped me get that connection between what's actually happening, what I'm looking at, and then what I'm doing in this like modeling. And it was pretty sweet. And I also got to do a few field seasons, and lake sturgeon are cool. So
yeah, so I was going to ask you about if you were collecting the sturgeon.
Yeah, so I kind of asked if I could do field work, even though I was hired as a strictly lab person. And they were like, sure, go ahead. And I learned that like, wow, like I'm not a fish person because I've never been fishing. Like I had never like touched or handled a fish. And like all of a sudden I'm meeting these like giant 6-foot fish that were like kind of docile and like super like cool to look at. And like we worked in a hatchery. So we had everything from young of year all the way to 4-year-olds. And it was just like the craziest thing because you could like keep track of like who was related to who, based on how we were doing the crosses. So there was that kind of genetic aspect and we were learning how to sample genetically, but you were also like looking at the real life fish and watching where it was living in its environment. So then when you went back and did an analysis, you could actually visualize what that fish was going through when it was migrating, or like where the spawning sites were and how like you might get some weird relationship things going on just because of the way sturgeon spawn. So it was super cool to see that. And we actually worked on a system that's totally landlocked, where there's no access to the Great Lakes. So it's this like really cool mesocosm where they're migrating from a lake upstream and then back to this small lake. And they had every individual genetically, every adult genetically and physically tagged. So it was like you could
in the lake you were working on.
Yeah, so you could answer all the questions to your heart desires.
Wow, that's really amazing. Like you said, it's a cool little confined mesocosm. I am going to have to admit that although I am originally from Michigan, I know virtually nothing about Great Lakes fish or fisheries. I have almost all of my fisheries experience and background is in the Southeast. So is there more that you can tell me about sort of the life cycle of lake sturgeon?
Yeah, well, so lake sturgeon, they are broadcast spawners just like all other sturgeon, I think. And basically they mature at like age 16 to like 20. And they run upstream and then broadcast spawn in various spawning zones. So I think there were like three or four zones that we knew that's where the lake sturgeon spawned. So we actually were wearing wetsuits and snorkel goggles, and we were snorkeling and then diving down for the sturgeon and grabbing them in a net, bringing them upstream and like extracting their gametes and like doing biological measurements.
Wait, you were you were grabbing adult sturgeon in a net?
Yeah.
Like 6 foot adult sturgeon?
Yeah. And like, I'm like a 5'6", 120 pound, like I'm not a big person.
Yeah.
And like, it was difficult. Like I didn't do the diving very often. I was mostly just like on the beach. But the one time I did it, like I caught a sturgeon.
That's crazy.
Oh, it was so, like, when I say, like, they're docile, like,
yeah, I guess so.
I was
huh?
like, that's not possible. And then I was like, oh, this is totally possible.
Okay, so in this little system that you were working on, they come out of the lake, they go upstream, they spawn, and they come back to the lake. Is that sort of how lake sturgeon and larger systems work as well?
Yeah, so I got to help a grad friend during my master's also sample for larval sturgeon, and it's very similar. I think it's the same thing in Wisconsin as well. They come, run upstream, spawn at certain sites, and then go back down. However, one of the main issues is dams, which kind of obviously block many fish from migrating. So it's usually a very popular study for lake sturgeon because it is such a strong thing. But I never really worked on the dam system. I was just aware of it.
You said you also studied burbot?
Yeah, so that I didn't get to do any field work, which I'm actually kind of happy about because burbot spawn under the ice in the middle of winter. They're Loda Loda, which is their scientific name, and they are related to cod, very similar lifestyles. I was happy they just gave me the fin clips and that was it.
You don't want to go ice diving?
Not particularly. That's kind of where I'm like, eh.
So after your bachelor's at Michigan State, you moved on to get a master's at the University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point, and you were studying Cisco. Now, I've heard of Cisco. I've heard that there's a big sampling program in the Great Lakes that they have dubbed the Cisco Inferno.
Yes.
Were you a part of that?
No. So I was adjacent to that project where I was actually building the genetic and genomic materials for them to study it in the best way they possibly could. But I never actually did like the large Great Lakes project. And we have it like on Twitter, you can find us using like hashtag Team Cisco or sometimes like hashtag Cisco sisters show up. And so that's kind of like Ellen George and Amanda Atkiss and Hannah LaChance worked on all of that Great Lakes stuff. And I developed a lot of the tools that they end up using on their research.
Can you tell us a little bit more about Cisco the fish?
Yeah. So I'm going to stick mostly genetics right now, just because that's kind of my roadhouse. There is always kind of like, are Cisco actually a salmonid? And any geneticist that's looked at the genome will be like, yes, they're absolutely salmonids. For the main reason that they have this genome that you can either hate it and it's like the demise of your study, or it's the coolest thing you've ever seen. And it just has to do with the duplication in the genome where it gets really complex really fast. And I was like, I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. And all salmonids have that.
So they have two copies, like four copies of everything?
So they're tetraploidy. So yep, there's four copies. And basically what happened was, if you go back 100 million years ago, really quickly, there was this like moment where the ancestral species, it looked kind of like a northern pike, is what the literature says. And there was a spontaneous mistake, and the genome, the whole genome doubled entirely, which doesn't really change the species unless there's a need to change it, but it does provide double the material, so double the potential. And then if you fast forward, there is this kind of like global climate change where the water level started to rise, and there's this whole new like habitat, and that's where speciation starts to take in the salmonids. But this duplicated genome is kind of like going through, like it's mutating, it's changing, and then all of a sudden there's speciation, and then independently every species is changing genomically to have this like cool adaptations that start to happen.
What got you interested in the program at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point?
Yeah, so it was a pretty unique program where we are a part of the cooperative unit that's kind of across the United States, where we had like a lot of cool resources. We were able to work with USGS. So all of the fish that I ended up rearing were in partnered with the Great Lakes Science Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So we actually went sampling and then brought the fish back to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and they raised them for us. So that way we were able to have like the right aged fish for the study. So that was super cool that we were able to partner with them.
And
we actually made some crazy crosses that I didn't even know were possible.
So you used a variety of different species, not just Cisco?
No, we only used Cisco, but because of the duplicated genome, it's very complicated to look at unless you reduce it. And the easiest way to reduce it, this is going to sound crazy, but the easiest way to reduce it is to eliminate one of the parents. So what we did was we UV lit the sperm, and that breaks down the DNA in the sperm, but it doesn't kill the sperm. So then when you go and make the cross, you're able to stimulate cell division in the egg and create an offspring that can live just about until hatch. They usually die after that, but with only maternal DNA. So you remove one of that duplication so you can finally see what you're working with. And like, I didn't even know that was possible.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. So in this study, you were going out in the field catching adults and then spawning them in the lab?
No, so that makes it all so much better. So we actually spawned them in a hotel room. We brought a UV crosslinker into a hotel room and requested a room with a fridge. I brought all of the materials over from Stevens Point up to northern Michigan, just next to Mackinac Island, and we went and caught live fish. And then last year, the year before me, they actually brought the fish back to the hotel room and put them in the tub because they wanted them to be like as fresh as possible. And I was like, we don't need to do that. So we just dry spawned them, and I brought everything back with me into the hotel room and like put it in my little UV crosslinker and like made the crosses, and it was weird.
That is a pretty amazing story.
We called it MacGyver science.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think there's a lot of times when that, you know, MacGyver science is the way to do it and the way that it happens. So if you were out with friends and you were about to tell your favorite lab or field story from your career so far, what would that story be? And so, you know, the story where you'd be like, no shit, there I was.
This like doesn't relate to fisheries at all, so I kind of apologize about that. But when I was an undergrad, I studied abroad in New Zealand, and we had some free time, so I was like, oh, I'll go on a short hike, it'll be great. Like, you should never hike alone. So I walked out to the beach, and like there were some large boulders, and I was kind of exploring, and I went around one of them and was face to face with a large New Zealand fur seal that was like not happy to see me. He ended up swimming away, and like I guess I was just so like my big 5'6" frame like and wimpy little squeak like freaked him out or something, but he like it was the scariest moment of my life.
So as a PhD student now, your current research subject is mice. Your current research subject is desert mice. This seems like a pretty radical switch. What made you leave the world of fisheries and start looking to mice?
It is a little radical, and it's kind of strange to realize how radical that is in real time. One of the like main goals was I really wanted to learn like the cutting edge of genetics and genomics and like what you can actually do with all the information. And really the most popular way to do that is with model organisms. I never wanted to just do like basic science. Like ecology was always like so interesting to me and like what really kept the hook on the genomic craziness. So I found this lab that works on desert mice, but with this like weird adjacent system with like crazy ecological adaptations. And we work on respirometry and physiology and gene expression, which is all 100% relevant to any system on the planet. And because we're taking a climate change approach where we're assuming the planet is going to continue to warm and the environments are going to get extreme, that we want to understand it from an animal that already lives in that kind of environment. My goal is to do this on like migrating fish or fishes that adapted to extreme environments, but I had to like figure out a way to learn it first.
Sure, that absolutely makes sense. And so you want to, your ultimate goal is to take this information that you learn and apply it into a fisheries context or a fish context?
Yeah, it's really, I haven't really found a good link where you can do respirometry on like most of the stuff that like I work on or I'm trying to learn right now is almost always done on some sort of model organism. It's kind of hard to do it on a fish just because nobody's really done it yet. My kind of goal is to like learn how to do it and then be like, okay, I'm going to do it on the coolest system I can find, which for me is probably fish.
And so do you think you're going to stick probably with lake fish or start looking into the marine environment?
So I have never, ever looked at marine environments. I've always been a Great Lakes girl. I think it would be so cool, but it would also be kind of terrifying. So like when I switched to the mice and the mammals, like that was the scariest moment of my life because I realized I didn't know anything about, like I knew the genetics, I could figure out like some math and some modeling, whatever, but I didn't know anything about mammals and I didn't know anything about mice. So I feel like I'd have the same realization with saltwater fish because like it'd be the same thing where I'm like, well, I know something about fish, I know something about genetics, but I don't know anything about like these fish in this environment. So it'd be like a huge learning curve.
Sure, that totally makes sense. I mean, like I admitted before, I grew up in Michigan and people always assume that I know things about the Great Lakes. And I'm like, I don't know anything about the Great Lakes or Great Lakes fish or Great Lakes fisheries or anything even remotely to do with freshwater. I have always been an estuary and a marine.
One of the reasons I chose genetics was because you could literally work on anything because everything has DNA. So like this, the steep learning curve and the huge challenge of like switching from one system to the other was like always really exciting because you're not ever doing the same thing over and over. Like you're going to change, like something's going to change or you can make it change so you don't get bored, but you're not really learning new techniques. You're like learning a whole new system and then applying your techniques that you know. So it's very comforting that I can go back to this, these genetic techniques I know on like a crazy system.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. That's such a smart move. If money were not an issue, what's one project you would like to get involved with in the future, you think?
More salmon or more sturgeon? Salmon have like really well established genomic resources. It'd be like the ecology and like some of their crazy adaptations that would be super exciting to work on. Or like sturgeon, so we talked about salmon, which have, they're tetraploidy, so there's four copies. Lake sturgeon are octoploidy, so there's eight copies of their genome at various stages of duplication. That's the craziest thing I've ever heard. Like, I don't even know what that looks like. And that's so exciting to me.
That is crazy.
Like, you can visualize one duplication, but to visualize like eight, I don't even know what that means. And I want to.
So it was tetraploidy and then it doubled again.
Yeah. So like some, and like evolution got weird. I don't know how that happens, but I want to know.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a really good direction to go in to start looking at, you know, how they got this.
That's well, I guess they have like, I read recently that there's like approximately 120 chromosomes. Humans have like 23.
Wait, 120 pairs?
120 pairs of chromosomes. Like, whoa. What is that even? How do you even? I don't even know. Like, it's so exciting that like, I don't even know how to approach it.
I feel like a lot of plants are like that.
All the plants are like that.
Yeah, okay.
Someone asked me like, if I'm so interested in polyploidy, like, why don't I just go study plants? I was like, they don't move at all. Like, that's so, like, sure, they're genetically interesting, but then you kind of lose that, like, movement aspect or that rapid movement aspect, or you lose that, like, cool ecology. I was like, I don't want to diss on plants.
You can diss on plants all you want. This is a fish show. You can diss on plants and mammals and everybody if you want to. Birds.
Oh man, I've been attacked by like 7 birds.
So in addition to being a PhD student, you are also a person. And as a person, one of the things that you told me you like to do is rock climbing. And you also noted that that seems like a weird activity to get involved in since you're from Southeast Michigan. Southeast Michigan is very flat. I've never really gotten that involved in rock climbing. I've tried it a few times, but it seems like indoor rock climbing has just gotten huge everywhere. Do you do both indoor and outdoor?
Yeah, I much prefer outdoor. Indoor is really fun for training. It's really fun for getting to know people after work. It's a great place to go to like leave the office, because it really, the reason I like it is it's all encompassing. It takes your entire attention. Rock climbing is inherently dangerous. And it's just all encompassing. You're solving problems and you feel really accomplished at the end, which is like when you go home from like working on your PhD, you need just one win. And that's like usually my win is rock climbing. And I actually started outdoors before I started indoors. Michigan is located in this kind of sweet spot where you can drive many places where there are rocks for like a long weekend. So it was like this great escape during undergrad where we would drive down to Kentucky and just like climb over the weekend and come back and like keep on going.
Is there a lot of outdoor rock climbing in the White Mountains?
There is. The rock is really strange. It's like very slippery and the season is pretty short because it's so slippery, but I'm so excited to like go explore because I've never live where there's rocks.
What's your favorite rock climbing memory or your favorite location that you've been rock climbing?
Like Kentucky is really like where the Red River Gorge is. The sand is beautiful. The sandstone, sorry, is super like hard and it's got so much texture and it's just so interesting. And like the climbs are long. When you get on something, you're just kind of like, you just cruise. You just keep going and it's so beautiful. I just love it. And there's also like the river that runs through there and there's just so much like exploring and the community is amazing.
The rock climbing community?
Oh yeah. There's some of the like nicest and like supportive people I've ever met. And they come from all walks of life. You have all kinds of like, you have doctors that are climbing, there are engineers that are climbing, scientists, teachers. And it's just a really nice perspective to see like how they approach a problem and like how everyone's education kind of teaches them, like their learning education teaches them to solve something differently. And like the way they approach the problem is just so interesting. And the conversations are pretty good too.
I think a lot of times we really get kind of, you know, siloed into our own little thing. And it's cool to be able to branch out in all those different ways. We have reached the part of the episode where we ask each of our guests a few final questions. A few decades ago, Dr. Milton Love famously said, a true biologist will have a tattoo of their favorite organism on their body. So my question to you is, do you have any fish tattoos?
I don't have any tattoos. And I feel like if I were to ever maybe given, it might have to be a double helix.
What is your dream job or location?
I thought about this and I don't really have a spot yet, but like the requirements are it cannot be flat. And it has to have all 4 seasons. That leaves a lot of wiggle room, but like those are the requirements.
Don't go south of like North Carolina, maybe, because you definitely don't get winter.
Yeah, it's always funny. When I moved here, everyone was warning me about the winter. And I was like, I'm from the Midwest. You have to tell me about the summer.
And so finally, if there was one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
Science is for everybody. Science can happen at any pace, except maybe not glacially. It is for everybody. I'm pretty sure every year since like high school, someone's told me that like I can quit or like there are other options, like maybe this isn't for you. And it's just like, no, science is for everybody, whether you think you're good at it or not.
Danny, thank you so much for being here. It was a real pleasure chatting with you. And if people want to connect with you online, where could they find you?
Twitter is a great way to find me. And my handle is @DannyBlumstein. I check it every day because the community on there is just so supportive and amazing.
I agree. I really like Twitter, especially science Twitter.
Science Twitter is the best.
Thank you so much for listening. I want to remind everyone that we do now have a Patreon page for the show. So if you feel inclined, head on over to patreon.com/fisheriespodcast and check it out. If you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter @FishVecchio. The podcast is @FisheriesPod. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast or old-fashioned email at feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can download and subscribe to receive future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I'm Julie Vecchio, and thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, science is for everyone. Is it Burbot?
Yeah, it is Burbot. Load of love.